Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2015. Let the record show that we do not have a quorum. We won't need one for an informational hearing. We have four bills on the agenda today. This will be an informational hearing only, and we will not be taking any votes. These bills are an opportunity for our authors to talk about their proposals and start public conversation. We will need to end by 4 o'clock, as Senator Saxhog's committee needs to get started promptly at 4 o'clock in this room. So with that in mind, we'll ask the presenters to be concise and considerate of others who wish to be heard. The plan is to hear all the bills and all their presentations and have an opportunity for questions from the committee. And so with that said, we will start with Senate File 216, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. appreciate the opportunity to present one of many bills that I think are designed to help working families. And this first bill is a simple bill. As you look at the language, it's only a paragraph or two, I'll read it out loud. Gratuity is presented to an employee via inclusion on a debit charge or credit card shall be credited to that pay period in which they are received by the employee and for which they appear on the employee's tip statement. Where a gratuity is given by a customer through a debit charge or credit card, the full amount of gratuity must be allowed the employee. This simple bill repeals a state rule that currently allows employers to charge tipped employees and servers and bartenders the credit card transaction fees against the tip portion of the bill, where the customer pays both the restaurant charge and the tip on a credit card. This practice only is charges against the transaction fee. For example, a $50 bill with a $10 tip left on the credit card, that transaction fee, it would only be charged against the $10. Credit card transaction fees can range anywhere from 0.5% to 3% of the transaction, and in some instances may include a flat fee such as 10 cents. So we just think that this is a fairness issue. As I write out my tip for a dollar or two or 10 or $12, I actually do believe it actually is going to the employee for the service that they've provided for me and my family. This rule currently allows restaurants to charge their employees for the routine costs of doing business. We don't allow restaurants to charge staff for fees they may pay for taking checks. They don't charge the dishwasher for soap, the cook for the cost of pots and pans, the host or the hostess for the cost of the very credit card swipe machine used to process the payments. Now, further, other retailers don't engage in this practice. The grocery store doesn't deduct from the cashier's wages if I pay for my groceries with a credit card, neither does the dry cleaner or any other Main Street retailer. Nine other states and several major cities prohibit this practice already, and I urge you to make Minnesota the 10th state as we consider this maybe in the next session or future. So I have a couple of, at least two at this time, testifiers. Any preference? Okay. Wait.
Okay, I guess I'm going
ahead. All right.
Just flip a coin. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We are a labor organization of over 1,000 affiliated unions representing over 300,000 working men and women throughout the state. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 216. Today's society is moving increasingly towards becoming a paperless society, and that includes the way we pay for goods and services. It is rare that people pay in cash, and even more rare to pay by check, especially with the reward systems attached to credit cards. The convenience of throwing down plastic comes with a price, at least to the business owners. Credit card processors charge a fee for processing these transactions. These credit card fees may include per-transaction fees, sometimes called swipe fees, as well as monthly or annual fees. Many businesses find ways to add these fees back into the cost of goods and services to pass them back to consumers. When you eat at a restaurant and pay with a card, those processing fees will be charged to the restaurant. Now, the restaurant may have added an extra quarter to the cost of your meal to make up for the fee, but you also tipped, right? The portion of the tip on the bill also gets hit with a swipe fee, so the employer must either choose to eat the swipe fee on the tip or pass it along to the tipped employee. Many restaurants pass these costs on to their tipped employees just like they do their customers. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, where tips are charged on a credit card and the employer must pay the credit card company a percentage on each sale, the employer may pay the employee the tip less that percentage. For example, where a credit card company charges an employer 3% on all sales charged to its credit card, its credit service, the employer may pay the tipped employee 97% of the tip without violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. The amount due the employee must be paid no later than the regular payday and may not be held while the employer is awaiting reimbursement from the credit card company. So as Senator Dahl said, if you put a $10 tip on your family's $50 meal and put the whole thing on a credit card, your server will only receive what's left after the service fees. It's estimated that this will reduce the service tips by about 2%. On the one hand, 2 to 3% isn't that much money. But to a server whose base salary is the minimum wage and basically relies on tips to pay the bills, every penny matters. As a customer, I intend for 100% of my tip to go to the staff, not some credit card company. As a server, I'd quit. If the restaurant doesn't want to pay fees on credit transactions, they shouldn't accept credit cards as payment. They have control over that. Servers have exactly zero control over whether or not people tip in cash or credit and shouldn't be punished for it. Let's say as a server you make $30,000, and half of that comes from credit card tips. In some areas, it'd be a higher percentage where people pay with or tip in cash. You'd be paying $375 a year in fees. That's insulting, especially since servers are already making a low hourly wage. And again, as Senator Dahl said, 10 states already prohibit this practice: California, Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Kansas, Maine, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Texas, and Utah. Minnesota should join these states in prohibiting this unfair practice and support Senate File 216. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Lundberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and Senator Dahl for hearing my testimony today. My name is Wade Lunenberg, and I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions. We represent thousands of employees in hospitality, including a number of the people that would be that are directly impacted by the current policy. While there's been a fair amount of discussion about income earned from tips and my industry's need for a tip penalty, Senate File 216 is trying to simply correct a rule in law that is having a discriminatory impact on a specific classification of worker. Unite Here recognizes that the policy of passing credit card fees on to Minnesota's nearly 50,000 servers is legal, but in our opinion, that rule is an outlier that does not line up with the balance of other tipped rules under the minimum wage law. The rules are clear that tips are the sole property of the employee, with this rule being the exception. We believe that credit card fee rules unfairly discriminate against a single classification of worker in the hospitality operation. In hospitality operations, we recognize that there are different kinds of workers, including culinary staff, stewarding and dishwashers, hosts, runners, servers, expediters, and certainly managers. Operators and owners have a certain number of costs of doing business, including rent, utilities, product, labor, and finance. In the realm of finance, there are taxes, payroll services, accounts payable, receivable, and business services, including the need to process credit card transactions. Employers are not allowed to charge the fee against other employees in the operation, including the culinary staff or the stewards, who, by the way, work very hard at what they do to make any operation successful. Fees are not charged against managers or cashiers, again, an integral part of any operation. Instead, one classification of worker, the server, is responsible to cover this business expense. Ironically, they are the only minimum wage earners in the operation and are also the chief sales force. The question is, why are servers nicked for these fees? Simply because they are the worker who processes a transaction. Why are the chief salespeople in these establishments singled out? Again, they are simply the worker who happens to be processing a business transaction. at the gas station, grocery store, clothing store, or any professional services, I do not believe that the employer has the ability to do such a thing. Why does this industry get to do it differently from others? We sincerely believe this practice is discriminatory on its face, targeting one classification in the workplace, and today we urge you to support Senate File 216 and further ask that rules would be required that all credit card transactions be completed by authorized managers, supervisors, cashiers, and owners, so that we can put this discriminatory practice against 50,000 workers in Minnesota back into the and put these transactions back into the cost of doing business column. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundenberg. Senator Dahl, do you have any other folks that would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, we have one other testifier in favor of the bill. I think Ms. Jensen, is she here?
Hi, my name is Ginger Jensen, and I've been a tipped worker for most of my life. And I just wanted to say a few things about the reality of who the tipped workforce is and what it means to cut into wages with something like a transaction fee. And really, it's since the recession, you know, most job growth has been in low-wage sectors and serving jobs. And introducing or passing transaction fees onto workers now would really send a message that Minnesota institutionalizes and embraces low wages. When Minnesota women are already losing $8 billion a year to the gender pay gap in our state alone, and while women make up the majority of low-wage workers, women are the majority of servers as well, the largest section of tipped workers. Already, servers experience poverty at three times the rate of the rest of the workforce as a whole. And the reality is we cannot win in closing the gender pay or racial equity gaps if we follow the logic of cutting into workers' wages and passing on such things as transaction fees. As servers and back-of-house staff, we are professionals who make a restaurant successful. And it does not mean that higher wages will be passed on to other workers or back-of-house staff, but actually these fees open the door to a poverty wage floor and further exploitation of workers. Last year, Minnesota workers organized and fought for a raise in the state minimum wage, and introducing loopholes would gut what workers have already won and would be a step backwards. I've been encouraged, as someone who's been a tipped worker for most of my life, to see organized workers who make significantly more than the minimum wage coming out in solidarity against sub-minimum wage or loopholes or methods to punish workers who, at the end of the day, just run a credit card transaction. It singles out a section of the service industry for a fee which should be factored into an employer's business model. Passing transaction fees onto workers can result in workers losing hundreds of dollars a month when we cannot control whether customers pay in cash or with a credit card. So my point is really that the bottom line is that women and tipped employees should not shoulder the burden of doing business in the state of Minnesota, and I think it should be something we should support, not passing these fees onto the employers who just run a credit card at the end of the day. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. Senator Dahl, do you have other folks that would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, I have no other folks to testify in favor.
There will be some folks that would like to testify in opposition to the bill, but at the end we'll take all the folks that want to come up because there will be some opposition to all the bills, so we'll just do those at the end. Any committee members have any questions for Senator Dahl or testifiers?
Question.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl, when you made your opening remarks, you said that that there are restaurants who take the fees and apply them solely to the tip rather than to the complete charge. And I wondered if you meant to say that. That was what I heard, and it seemed unlikely.
Mr. Chair, I'll have Ms. Schaubach answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, in the statute, it actually does say it comes out of the server's tip, not out of the bill. So is the statute that's actually repealed, I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me, the 5200.0080 subpart 7. And I actually I might have a copy of that in mind.
I guess it's on the back, so let me look at that.
It's on there. So, Mr. Chair, that is my understanding of what it is we're
It says as in the same percentage as the total bill. So,
but it is, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, if you read the second paragraph of the rule there, it says the full amount of tip must be allowed the direct service employee minus only the percentage deducted from the tip in the same ratio as the percentage deducted from the total bill by the service company. But it is deducted from the tip, not from the total bill.
Senator Bonoff, follow-up?
Well, I think we're splitting hairs. I don't think that actually is accurate, but I'm not opposed to the bill. I'm just saying I don't think that's accurate. I think the way I read this, they're taking the percentage from the tip equal to the percentage from the whole. So in the $60 example, the 3% would be taken pro rata of the full amount. But it doesn't matter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff.
Yes. Mr. Fuller is agreeing with me.
It does matter. I mean, this is coming out of the server's tip.
And I appreciate that, but the way that Senator Dahl said it left an impression that the entire 3% was being assigned to just the tip portion, and that would not, I mean, that would be shocking. And so as I read this, it does not allow for that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
And obviously, as an informational hearing, it's certainly something we'd want to clarify. It would be a really good question for the restaurant owners.
It would be, yes. If there is anybody.
I know they will be testifying.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Hearing none, we'll set this bill aside, Senator Dahl, and thank you. The next bill that we will go to is Senate File 481, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for my opening statement, I did want to invite Mr. Hilario de Leon and his translator to join me up here so they're ready to go.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. If your testifiers would like to join Senator Pappas at the table so we can move along.
Mr. Chairman and members, every day a mom or dad in Minnesota is asked to make an impossible choice to either care for a loved one or keep a paycheck. When dealing with a sick child, a chronically ill parent, or just needing time to heal, there is no doubt what Minnesotans' priorities are. We put our families first. Unfortunately, too many workplaces just aren't family-friendly. 41% of workers in Minnesota don't have any earned sick or safe time. That's roughly 1 million Minnesotans. But not all Minnesotans are impacted equally. While 39% of white workers lack access, 42% of Asian workers, 47% of American Indian workers, and fully 60% of Latino workers lack access to earned sick pay. Similarly, access rates are the worst in many of the industries where you would want most employees reporting to work healthy. In the service sector, 65% of workers lack access to earned sick pay. This includes jobs like security guards, janitors, cooks, restaurant servers, home health aides, and personal care attendants. In other words, it's the people serving the public, preparing our food, and caring for the sick or elderly. Finally, in addition to the million Minnesotans who lack access, thousands more are saddled with policies that are actually punitive. Even though some workers earn paid time off due to sickness, they can still be disciplined, denied promotions, or even fired when they use it up. This has led many parents to choose to quit rather than be fired when they've had chronically sick kids or parents. Senate File 481 would help us solve this problem by setting a new standard for earned sick and safe time for all Minnesota families. The bill accomplishes that through the following. It sets an accrual rate of 1 hour of earned sick and safe time for every 30 hours worked. It allows employees of large employers, those with 21 employees or more, to accumulate up to 9 days per year. And employees of small employers, those with 20 employees or under, will accumulate up to 5 days per year. So there's actually a ceiling. Employees may use earned sick and safe time for themselves or their family members for treatment of a mental or physical illness, an injury or health condition, diagnostic or preventative care, and services related to domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. Retaliation for the use of earned sick and safe time is prohibited. Paid time off or PTO systems and collective bargaining agreements that meet the minimum standards of the law are exempted. To make all this possible, the bill also offers employees and employers, nonprofits, and the Department of Labor and Industry the tools that they need to implement, monitor, and enforce the law. This bill gives us a chance to make sure all Minnesotans can care for themselves or their loved ones when they need to. It will make our businesses safer and our communities more healthy. We can end the impossible choice and make more possible for these 1 million Minnesota workers. Members, I have with me to begin with Mr. Hilario de Leon and his translator, who's going to make his statement.
If you would go ahead and state your name and your position and go ahead with your testimony.
Gracias, señor presidente. Mi nombre es Hilario de Leon. Yo trabajo en downtown Minneapolis. In a Target.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Hilario de Leon, and I work in downtown Minneapolis cleaning the Target store there.
Vengo aquí para decir que días de la enfermedad necesito decirle que necesito unos beneficios para mí.
I came here to say that I need sick days because I don't have them, and I need those benefits for myself.
De mi trabajo no tengo ningún beneficio.
I don't have any benefits at work.
El beneficio quería ni del vacaciones pagado, días de enfermedad, días de uno por decir que tiene que ir uno cuando uno está enfermo a trabajar.
And I don't have any paid time off, and I need paid sick days because when I'm sick, I go to work anyway, so I come to work sick.
Y decirle que cuando uno está enfermo, tiene que ir la fuerza por el problema que tiene, el miedo que tiene, no es una aquí de este Estados Unidos.
And I feel forced to go to work when I'm sick because I'm afraid to stand up to my boss.
Porque tengo que ir la fuerza a trabajar por decir que si estoy enfermo, porque por decir me corre y no tengo papeles de aquí.
And I'm afraid that I could be fired if I don't come to work even when I'm sick.
No solo por decir afectamos nuestros compañeros si por decir a las fuerzas me voy así enfermo.
And I feel that I can make my coworkers sick as well if I come to work when I'm sick.
Y por decir que por mi historia si no voy a trabajar enfermo pues me van a correr o por decir que aquí nada más.
Uh-huh. And so, again, I have to come to work sick or I fear that I may be fired, and that's how it is.
Y por decir, necesita hacer un cambio a tener un beneficio, porque en estos no responde para nada. Y entonces, no solo a mí que vengo enfermo, la mitad de mis compañeros vienen a trabajar enfermos.
Mm-hmm. And so we really need this change because it's not just me, it's also my coworkers. Over half of them come to work when they're sick.
Entonces, por eso necesito tener un cambio por los beneficios.
And so that's why we really need a change to have these benefits.
Por la razón de eso, por eso buscamos mucha manera para decirle que algunas de que nos apoyan entre nosotros.
And so we're asking for you to support us.
Thank you, Mr. De Leon. Senator Pappas, do you have other testifiers?
Yes, I'd like to ask now Yvonne Cornier from NCASA to join me and Melanie Peterson-Hickley from the Department of Health.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Yvonne Cornier. I am the Prevention Program Manager for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Thank you, Senator Pappas, for bringing this bill forward. I'm here to speak specifically to the safe leave provisions of this bill, which will go a very long way to helping victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking access the help they need to recover from this trauma. For illustration, here are some of the issues that victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking need to address. They need to seek medical help, including a sexual assault advocate or sexual assault forensic exam if needed, or other forms of medical care. They need to access safety. Sometimes they need to think about where they're living, make changes in where they're living, maybe seek shelter or find a friend or a family member that they can live with, or find a whole new home and actually end up moving. They need help accessing law enforcement, including making a report, preparing for legal action. They also sometimes need legal help with finding orders for protection. They also need help or need time to make arrangements for children, including determining where their child will be the safest and possibly needing to change schools. So these are just some of the kinds of the aftermath of sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking. And so we support the need for being able to use sick time, safe and sick time for this. Because otherwise, victims are forced to make those impossible choices between losing hours, a paycheck, or a job in order to avail themselves of the services that they need to begin to recover from the trauma and the harm. The legislation brought forward by Senator Pappas helps workers have the time they need to get the services that they need for themselves and often also sometimes for their family members. This is a win-win for employers and employees because when victims are able to get the help they need to stabilize their life, they're more likely to stay on as a healthy, productive employee in the long run. So access to economic security is a means to safety.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Peterson, please
Good afternoon.
State your name.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Peterson-Hickey, and I'm the Acting Director of the Center for Health Equity at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm pleased to be here today to provide comments on the MDH white paper on paid leave submitted in response to a request by Minnesota legislators. To begin, I'd like to provide a brief overview of the findings that we identified in the course of writing the report. The first of these is that healthy individuals, families, and communities are the foundation of a well-functioning, productive Minnesota. Many factors contribute to health, including the policies and systems that shape the nature of everyday life. Paid leave is one of these policies. The benefits of paid leave do not accrue only to individuals or families. Employers, communities, and systems all benefit from people's ability to care for one another and also fulfill their job responsibilities. When paid leave policies are present, families are healthier, people are healthier, they use less sick time, they need less health care, and their children do better in school. Research supports that more equitable access to paid leave can contribute to the improved health of Minnesota and to our economy. There are a number of benefits to paid leave and other flexible, family-friendly policies that are mentioned in this paper, including benefits to employers, community, individuals, and perhaps most important, to babies, children, and families. Employers benefit because of enhanced recruitment. Positions are more attractive to job seekers. Retention, they're more likely to stay in their positions, and employee morale. When employee morale is high, productivity is increased. People with paid leave are also less likely to take time off work and less likely to spread illness to coworkers and customers. Employers benefit, too, because paid leave policies are also associated with lower rates of occupational injury, especially for workers in industries with high injury rates. Potential costs to employers due to a lack of paid leave include lost labor time, diminishing labor output, challenges recruiting and retaining employees, and the cost related to the spread of illness in the workplace. Communities benefit also with paid leave policies in place. Lack of paid leave policies impact community members and their capacity to care for one another, as Senator Pappas has mentioned. One example that we provided in the report was the of the community's ability to care for one another is when adult children are caring for elderly or disabled parents or are the primary caregiver for a sick child. Another example that we provide in the paid leave paper indicates that sick or recently sick food workers were identified as the source of or likely source of over 200 confirmed foodborne illness outbreaks, resulting in nearly 3,000 documented illnesses in Minnesota from 2004 to 2013. Because not all foodborne illnesses are recognized or reported, the figures likely underestimate the incidence of foodborne illness spread in this fashion. Individuals also benefit. Employees with paid sick leave or paid leave are less likely to work while sick and recover more quickly from illness. They're more likely to visit their health care provider and less likely to end up in emergency rooms. Paid leave also supports family health. As I said, maybe most importantly, babies, children, students, and parents benefit from paid leave and other flexible leave policies. Research confirms that the foundation for future relationships, health, and capacity to learn and thrive throughout the life begins before birth and is influenced strongly during the first 3 years of life. When paid leave policies are available, parents, caregivers, and communities are more likely to be able to cultivate stable and nurturing relationships in order to provide positive environments for children. Paid leave has been found to encourage breastfeeding, and we know the research shows that the benefits of breastfeeding to children's health. These have been widely documented, including lower rates of mortality, lower rates of malnutrition, and infection. In fact, paid leave has also been associated with lower infant mortality and better infant health. Access to paid leave allows workers who are also caregivers the flexibility they need to provide and seek care for their family members. An analysis of a national survey data from a national survey found that employees without paid leave delayed seeking care or were unable to obtain medical care for a family member. But the paper also found that access to paid leave is not distributed equally across populations in Minnesota. Workers with lower incomes and women with lower education levels are less likely to have access to paid leave. Access to paid leave varies by race. People of color and American Indians in Minnesota are less likely to have paid leave than whites. Access to maternity leave also varies by mother's race and ethnicity. Employer size, industry, and the type of job also determine the availability of paid leave. Small employers and low-paying jobs are less likely to offer paid leave. As our understanding of the factors influencing health increases, the benefits of paid leave to individual, family, and community health are becoming clearer. Minnesota is becoming more diverse, and employment is growing in sectors that do not typically provide paid leave. Because employees without access to paid leave are also more likely to be working in low-wage jobs, they're often forced to choose between caring for their own or a family member's health or losing wages or even their jobs. Going to work while sick or shortly after welcoming a baby may allow workers to maintain their jobs or income in the short term, but may result in greater problems in the longer term. The communities most in need, and this is the most significant finding from our report, is that the communities that are most in need are the ones that are least likely to benefit from the current leave policies. These are the same communities that are also experiencing other barriers to health. Addressing disparities in access to paid leave is an important step in supporting the health and well-being of working Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson-Hickey. Senator Pappas, do you have other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chairman. So I would just like to thank the chairman and the members for the informational hearing. And obviously, Ms. Peterson was talking about paid leave policies in a more broad way. We were talking here about earned sick, but I know we also have had paid family leave policy discussions before the committee with Senator Stevens' bill.
Any questions or concerns, comments from the committee? Any committee members have any questions? Seeing none from the committee, I do have some concerns in the bill myself that I'd just like to expose to the record. The first one is the required statement of earnings by employers. I realize that this is a sick leave bill, and so I'm a little concerned about that being in there. Another one that I'm concerned about, Senator Pappas, is the 3 days that the employees can take 3 days off without undocumented need. I do have some concern there, and of course my another concern I have is we're exempting the unions on this bill, and I don't know that that's the direction we should be going, but I know that we're not here to debate that today. We're just for informational purposes only, so I just wanted to bring that up. So
thank you. I appreciate hearing your concerns.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, this is an interesting bill. I have two questions. Well, first let me say we all realize how important it is that we have healthy employees at work. And that's why I was glad to support our expansion of family caregiver and sick leave last year. And many employers have found that it is in their best interest to make sure that employees are healthy while they're at work. So I support the premise upon which this bill is made, but I have two questions. One is, what's the interaction with this bill and PTO, personal time off? We're finding that more and more employers are going to personal time off as opposed to sick leave. And so how does this interact with PTO?
If an employer provides PTO, as well as a union contract that allows for paid sick leave or PTO, they are exempt from the requirements under this bill.
Mr. Chair?
If it's equivent to
Senator
what the
Nelson.
Bill requires.
Yes. Follow up.
Yep, and so, but what if when you said the word and a union contract, so what if it's a private employer that has PTO, but they don't have a union contract?
Not and or.
Right. Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So if you are a private employer and you have a PTO policy that is equivalent or better than what's required in the law, then you're exempt from the law.
Okay. Thank you.
Other committee members have questions? Seeing no other questions, Senator Pappas, this will be set aside, and thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Actually, there are two additional questions that are one comment and one question on this bill before we set it aside.
Okay.
Oh, I think Senator Pappas has left.
Senator Pappas?
Oh, one further question.
Oh, okay. All right. Senator Nelson.
I was wondering if the first testifier who spoke about the need for this bill and being concerned about standing up to his employer, that's very concerning to hear someone who feels threatened. And my question would be, I thought I understood that the testifier's interpreter said he worked at Target, and I just wanted to know if that was the employer. Is Target the employer? That's a frightening comment.
I believe he did, Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson. We can bring him back, but I believe I heard him say, too, he worked for the downtown Target.
Could we get clarification on that? I think that's very important.
Would you like to bring him back?
Yes, Target is one of our largest employers in the state, private employers. I'd be rather surprised, but I think we should clarify that. That'd be good to know.
Yeah. Is he still here? Hilaria still here? And the translator, if you could come back to the table. And while they're coming, I believe he did say that he was worried his supervisor would not appreciate it if he took time off when he was sick, and he was very worried about being fired. And we can have him repeat that.
Mr. DeLeon and Know, did the interpreter understand the question, or Senator Nelson?
I
understand.
The question.
Okay.
Gracias, señor presidente. Mi nombre es Hilario de León.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm Hilario de León again.
Mi compañía se llama Prestige. Mis supervisores son del parte de Prestige.
So to clarify, I work for a company called Prestige, and my employers are from that company, Prestige.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
So it'd be like an outside contractor.
Yeah, they're a contractor.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Good thank you for the clarification. That's helpful. Is that what you're looking for, Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was, and I so appreciate the ability to get some clarity on that. And I'd like to make just one more comment.
Senator Nelson.
And it's not necessarily to the testifiers. But I just want to say that I'm really disappointed in this white paper on paid leave and health. I'm hoping the taxpayers didn't pay a lot of money for this because, well, like I said, I agree with the premise. There is not much in this white paper as far as statistics, studies. There's just a lot of maze and mites, and I would have liked to have seen some real data on how people's health with paid sick leave compares with people's health who don't have paid sick leave. So I'm just saying that on the public record that I think there's a lot that's left out in this white paper, and I guess I would not even really consider it a white paper. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pappas.
Yeah, response. Madam Chair, I just was consulting a little bit with the Department of Health. We just included the executive summary in your packets. So if you would like a copy of the full report, which does have other studies that it's based on, we'll get that to you.
Thank you very much. So I might have to retract my comments. I just didn't see the meat in this paper. Thank
Maybe
you.
Maybe we can get that for members. We'll get it for Senator Bonoff. I see her shaking her head, too. So thank you for that clarification, Senator
Pappas.
We can get it for the whole committee. Okay. Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, Mr. DeLeon did want to make one additional comment.
Okay,
as long as you brought him back up here.
Okay, go ahead. Mr. DeLeon.
Okay. Sí, por decir más de 30 o 35%, y por decir que no tenemos días de pagado por estar de enfermos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that in our work it's like 30% more likely that one will have an accident at work if they don't have access to paid sick days.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you,
Senator Pappas. Senator Tomassoni, Senate File 1328, we have on the agenda next. Welcome
Thank
to the
you,
committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, and Senate File 1328 is named the Wage Theft Protection Act. And members, wage theft is a real problem for workers and their families, and many workers are refused pay for hours worked, paid less than the legally state mandated minimum wage, denied overtime pay, or required to work off the clock. According to the Economic Policy Institute, wage theft costs American workers more than $30 billion per year. And according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports, robberies, burglaries, and larcenies and car thefts cost their victims less than $14 billion per year. What legitimate business would support cheating workers out of their actual wages that they earn? And businesses who play by the rules and pay workers the correct pay for hours worked have nothing to fear by this legislation. This legislation, if enacted into law, would only affect those businesses that cheat their workers out of their wages they earn. Some of the things that the legislation does is it increases penalties for employers guilty of wage theft. From double to triple the amount owed to the employee. It provides criminal penalties for employers who willfully or repeatedly violate this law. It ensures all wage theft complaints are confidential, allows the state to revoke a business's license or for noncompliance or multiple abuses and paying back and lost wages and several other things. And what I'll do, Mr. Chairman, is I'll turn this over to my witness, and she can actually give you some information on the bill and some more statistics about wage theft.
Okay, Senator. Ms. Schaubach, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I guess I wasn't talking loud enough, so I will.
Close enough to the microphone.
Oh, got it. So I can walk through a little bit of the provisions of the bill. Section 2, like Senator Tomasoni said, allows for anonymous complaints to the Department of Labor involving minimum wage, overtime, or prevailing wage, and the complaints are exempted from the Data Practices Act, so complaining parties' identities won't be subject to information requests from the public. This, again, goes to kind of Senator Nelson's comments about retaliation from an employer. There are studies that have shown that the majority of people who report or try to report, complain to their employer about wage theft are retaliated against in some way, shape, or form. Section 3 gets rid of exemptions to minimum wage and overtime laws for certain agriculture employees. Section 4 changes the maximum weekly hours before overtime is due from 48 to 40. It also gets rid of a third exemption to minimum wage and overtime laws for certain agriculture employees. And this actually applies to kind of the sugar beet workers, and it's just kind of an outdated law. Section 5 changes the requirement for employee rest breaks to 10 minutes per 4 hours of work. Section 6 changes the requirement for employee meal breaks at least a 30-minute break during a shift of 5 hours or longer, and there is also an exemption for shifts of 6 hours or shorter. An employee and an employer can agree to not have a meal break. Section 7 makes three changes. First, it provides for treble damages or triple damages in administrative proceedings for violations of minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage law. Second, it increases the amount of civil penalties that the Department of Labor and Industry can levy on employers for willful or repeated violations of the minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws from a maximum of $1,000 per violation to a minimum of $5,000 and a maximum of $10,000 per violation. Third, it provides for the cancellation of various employer business licenses and permits for employers, again, who repeatedly or willfully violate minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws. Section 8 provides for triple damages for minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage violations in suits by private parties. Section 9 allows for an employee aggrieved under the minimum wage, overtime, or prevailing wage laws to choose to have another person or organization sue on the employee's behalf. Section 10 allows for anonymous complaints. The complaints may be formal or informal and may be brought by anyone. And it also provides that when the Department of Labor investigates such a complaint, it must review all employee documents at the relevant work site, both to protect the employee's identity and to determine if there is a pattern of violations at the workplace. Section 11 provides wage bonds to allow for the payment of employee wages if an employer appears likely to suddenly stop its operations. Section 12 requires the Department of Labor to execute all of its duties without regard to employees and employees' immigration status. Section 13 allows for the Department of Labor and Industry issue grants to community organizations for outreach about minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws. Section 14 is the anti-retaliation provision. Section 15 makes certain employer violations of minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws gross misdemeanors or felonies. Section 16 is a special appropriation. It provides that all fees collected for employer violations of minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws go into a special account, which is annually automatically appropriated to the department for the administration of enforcement of the 177 and 175. Section 17 adds items to be required on an employee's pay stub. We found that many times certain deductions are being illegally taken out of workers' paychecks, and so this just gives kind of an itemized deduction, basically, so an employee knows what overtime they've worked, what sick days they took, you know, any vacation time, any other, you know, deductions or additions to their wages. Section 18 actually is from a bill last biennium, House File 1013. In broad terms, this section requires businesses that contract for labor or services to put such contracts in writing and include specific provisions. If a business enters into such a contract and knows or should know that the dollar amount of the contract is not high enough to pay the people who will do the work under the contract they are due under any law, that business may be liable to the workers for wages owed and additional damages. So the previous testifier who talked about being a subcontractor, this is where we're finding a lot of issues. Businesses are contracting out cleaning services for their business, and obviously those subcontractors are bidding, and they look for the lowest bid, and they're not looking at whether or not those wages are actually getting paid to the people actually doing the work. And we've found this in several places, Target, Best Buy, I know TJ Maxx. There have been several cleaning, especially in the cleaning business. The subcontractors are, the actual workers are not being paid. So this makes the actual corporation, so if it's Target and they've subcontracted with a cleaning business, this can make Target liable for the workers not getting paid. Section 19 requires employees to annually provide a written statement to employees listing information on a number of subjects. Sections 20 and 21 extends the statute of limitations from 2 or 3 years to 6 years. And then there's an appropriation from the general fund for the department, and then any technical corrections that need to be made.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Thomas,
so wage theft is not incidental or rare, and it takes place in industries that span the economy, such as retail, restaurants, and grocery stores, caregiver industries such as home health care and domestic work, blue collar industries such as manufacturing, construction, and wholesalers. Building services such as janitorial and security, and personal services such as dry cleaning and laundry, car washes, and beauty and nail salons. Immigrants, women, and people of color are particularly hard hit, although workers are at risk of many forms of wage theft, being paid less than minimum wage, working off the clock without pay, getting less than time and a half for overtime hours, having tips stolen, and seeing illegal deductions taken out of our paychecks. So it's a very real thing that we need to address, I think, in our society, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Any questions for Senator Tomasoni or Ms. Schaubach? If not, ma'am, welcome to the committee.
Say your name for the record.
Solo quiero pedir cómo Susan va a traducir.
I just wanted to ask Susan, that's me, I'm going to translate.
Okay.
Señor Presidente, muchas gracias por tenernos aquí.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for having us here.
Mi nombre es Lucila Domínguez, y bueno, yo estoy aquí contando un poco mi historia de cómo yo he trabajado muchos 10 años en la industria de la limpieza.
My name is Lucila Dominguez, and I'm here to tell my story about how I've worked for about 10 years in the cleaning industry.
Y bueno, yo estoy hablando un poco sobre el robo de salario, ya que siempre todos los trabajos donde yo estuve trabajando, muchas veces me quedaron a deber dinero.
And I'm here to talk about wage theft because in almost every job I've worked, I've wound up with a company owing me money.
Una forma de cómo me roban mi salario es como me dan cheques sin fondo que voy a cobrarlos al banco y no tienen dinero.
One way that this happens is that I will be paid in checks that bounce when I go to cash them.
Eso fue cuando yo estaba limpiando edificios, apartamentos.
That happened when I was working cleaning apartment buildings.
Y otro trabajo donde también yo limpiaba restaurantes por la noche como Grand City, Applebee's, todo en restaurant.
And another place this happened when I was working at night cleaning restaurants like Applebee's.
Y también ahí en ese trabajo por la noche, ellos me pagaban un salario como $300 por quincena y todavía aparte quieren que de mi mismo salario yo tenía que comprar mis productos con que yo tenía que limpiar el restaurante.
So I worked overnight cleaning restaurants and I got paid about $300 a la semana?
Quincena.
$300 in a 2 week pay period. And even from that salary, I had to buy my own cleaning products.
Entonces, ha sido así en muchas formas de cómo me han robado salario.
And so, in there's several different ways that this wage theft has happened to me.
Y después, bueno, yo vine a esta organización de CETUL, Centro de Trabajadores.
And that's when I came to this, the organization CETUL, the Center for Workers United in Struggle.
Y yo empecé a buscar la forma de recuperar algo de dinero y en un trabajo de los restaurantes pude recuperar $1,800.
And so that's when I started to look for like the form of getting my wages back. And in one of these jobs, I was able to get like $1,800 back that I was owed.
Y en otro trabajo me ayudaron a recuperar $500.
And in another job, they helped me get back $500.
Y así es como en diferentes lugares he podido recuperar dinero de los mismos salarios que han robado.
And so in this way, I've been able to get back some of the money that has been stolen from me.
Y solo quiero mencionar que no solo soy yo, sino que muchos industrias en general, todas, están haciendo este tipo de robo de salario.
And I want to mention that it's not just me that this is happening to. This is happening in a lot of different industries.
Y bueno, miles de trabajadores también han podido recuperar salarios. Y esta organización CETUL ayudó a recuperar hasta 7 años a 1.8 millones en sueldos robados.
With this organization, in the past 7 years, we've been able to get back $1.8 million in stolen wages.
Y esto afecta mucho mi persona y de mis compañeros trabajadores, porque esto nos ayuda cuando tenemos ya un salario muy, muy bajo y luego todavía aparte que nos los estén quitando.
So, wage theft has a big effect because it affects me and also I know my fellow workers because in the first place, these are low-wage jobs and then besides that, they're taking money out of our check.
Si yo estoy contando que con ese dinero voy a comprar mi comida o pagar mi renta y después ese cheque no llega a mis manos.
And so that money is supposed to go to my food or to my rent, but then the check isn't in my hands.
Es una manera de como es frustrante saber que uno cuenta con un dinero que ya lo trabajó y después no lo pueda obtener.
And it's so frustrating to know that you're counting on that money that you already worked for and then you can't have it.
Y es que es por eso que venimos hoy aquí este día para ver sobre esta propuesta de Bill que todas compañías, tanto como contratistas como las corporaciones, sean responsables de estos salarios.
Mm-hmm. And so we're here today to support this proposed bill because we know it's the contractors, but it's also the companies who are responsible for this wage theft.
Toda parte e industria tienen ahora intermediarios contratistas que están haciendo como no quieren hacer responsable de estas cosas injustas que están haciendo.
So in lots of different industries, there's like intermediary contractors who don't want to be responsible for these injustices that are happening.
Y una de las formas que estoy diciendo que tanto el contratista como la corporación tiene que ser responsable es porque la misma corporación sabe que está cobrando la compañía de limpieza muy barato.
And so we know that the corporation as well as the company needs to be responsible because the corporation or the person who hires the contractor knows how little they're paying for the contract, for example, in the cleaning industry.
Esto quiere decir que también la corporación es responsable de estos robos.
This means that the corporations are also responsible for these thefts.
Muchas gracias por escuchar.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dominguez, for your testimony. Any questions for the witness or Senator Tomasoni?
Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni, go ahead, and I think Senator Dames has a question.
Ahead,
okay. Senator Dames.
Do you plan on opening it up for questions, or does he have any more testifiers? Or I would just like at some point, the Department of Labor and Industry to come forward. I've got a few questions for them.
Okay. Well, it's just Senator Nelson.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I just had two questions. One, isn't it already against the law to not pay people for work being done? I'm just a little concerned to think that people are getting money deducted from their paychecks that they didn't know about. And I'm thinking that's already against the law. I just want some confirmation from council here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson.
Senator Thomasoni.
You're absolutely right. And so this is not about putting new burdens on law-abiding employers. It's about trying to make sure that the law is enforced and that that people that are actually doing this do get punished. And so it's a matter of trying to enforce the laws that are already on the books for the people that aren't obeying them.
Okay. And maybe the department, if they come forward too, could shed a little bit more light on that, if that helps Senator Nelson. To Senator Dame's point, is that right?
Okay. Can I ask one final
Senator
question?
Senator Nelson, yep, sure, go ahead.
I'm just curious, what are the shirts? CTUL? Love the color. I see a few of them in the room here. What does that stand for?
Las playeras para que son representan las playeras.
No, simplemente es como siempre la manera que hablamos de nuestra organización y siempre por eso es que la traemos como representando siempre la clase obrera.
So these shirts are from our organization, which is SATUL, so we wear these shirts representing the working class. And the letters stand for the Centro de Trabajadores Unidos en Lucha, which is the Center for Workers United in Struggle.
Okay. Good. Good. Thank you, Senator. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Thomasoni, the reason I was open, the Department of Labor was here, that we could find out just how many complaints and stuff they have. And there's some issues on the bill that I'm very concerned about. And you had just stated that we're trying to get rid of the bad actors. And we're not doing anything to harm the good actors, but we are. When we look at this bill, there's a lot of things in here that are putting a lot of new reporting, a lot of new things that the good actors are going to have to comply with. Another concern I have is last year or a couple of years ago when the minimum wage bill was passed, there was a lot of work and effort to come up with a bill that was workable, and in that bill, agricultural had the 48-hour exemption, and we're peeling that out, and it's just like that's perfectly fine. The other concerns I have is that there's no penalties for employees that misrepresent things and that the companies have to defend themselves, and then they find out that the companies were correct. There's nothing in there to kind of slow that down. But I think the real concern of this bill is that the real concern I have of this bill is when I read the bill, I thought, gee, I wonder where this bill is coming from. And as I got a little further into the bill, I realized where it was coming from when it says that this bill does not apply to protective or to collective bargaining units. And if this is a good bill, and if it's a really good bill that's going to help everybody, then I think everybody should participate, and everybody should have to meet the same requirements, not just people that aren't part of a collective bargaining unit. So those are some of my concerns, Senator Thomasoni.
Go ahead.
Senator Thomasoni and Ms. Schaubeck, if you'd like to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dames. The collective bargaining exemption language is pretty standard throughout the statute. There's no protections for any employer who is guilty of wage theft. And part of the questions are, there's a lot of questions about, you know, this is disturbing. Yes, it is. Employers are getting a slap on the wrist, and they think it's okay to steal $50, $100 a week from employees because these employees are low-wage workers who do not have the resources or the time to take it to court. They don't know where to file these claims. They're afraid of retaliation from their employers. I'm kind of curious, Senator, if the question about the employees misrepresenting. I would have a question about how an employee would misrepresent not having gotten their appropriate wages and why they would do that. If it went to court, I would assume that, or even an attorney, a labor law attorney or wage and hour attorney or the Department of Labor and Industry, if they were investigating it, would find that the employee was incorrect in looking for those what they thought were lost wages.
Most of these actually recommendations come from the National Employment Law Project. Once the recession hit, there were many, many cases across the country on wage theft. And if you visit the U.S. Department of Labor's website, they have some pretty good graphics if you want to look at those, and or I have some handouts. But part of the problem is that our system is complaint-based, and so making things more proactive, and we just recently got – sorry. Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, Steve reminded me that collectively bargained people that are workers that are representative have a grievance process. Those that are not represented by a union do not have that representation or that process to grieve.
Okay. Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think as it relates to frivolous complaints being made, I think that there has been somewhat of an industry created in this country, sometimes because smaller businesses don't have the resources that larger businesses do. Sometimes it's easier to make complaints against them in hopes that there will be a settlement at some point, and because it's cheaper than going through with defending themselves in the case of a lawsuit. And you reference legal people, and I think there are sometimes legal people that have made a career of that. And so I think that Senator Dames' concern is indeed valid. I also think that as we, look at these issues, I think if the system that we have in place isn't enforcing the rules that we have, I don't think that the automatic answer is making more rules. And I think that we need to be concerned about that and also recognize that as you look at some of the penalties that are in this legislation, there are honest mistakes made in the world. Payroll is not necessarily the easiest set of records to always compute and get done and whatever the case may be. As these type of penalties go, even those who make honest mistakes, I think at times in how this is set up, if they catch it themselves, might be tempted to say, oh, I need to get this corrected. They might quite frankly be tempted to hope that it goes, that nobody else catches it. And quite frankly, I think that does a disservice to the employees that are supposed to be protected here. I just see an awful lot of problems in this type of legislation as far as being fair to everyone concerned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber.
Ms. Schaubach.
This in no way, this again, it says willful and repeated violations, and that's kind of where those increased penalties will fall. This is not for employers that make a simple mistake in payroll. This is for the thousands of workers out there who have been robbed of their wages for years. There was a recent case just settled on a prevailing wage case where a company had, the gentleman was held accountable, felony by swift swindle of theft or something, but thousands of dollars worth of wages that he was pocketing the difference in the prevailing wage that he was supposed to be paying his workers. So this is a real problem out there. And again, we don't want to hurt the good employers. But if we want to make it fair for everyone, including the worker, making the rules a little better is probably the way to go.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
When you hear numbers like wage theft costs American workers more than $30 billion per year, and that robberies, burglaries, larcenies, and car thefts cost less than $14 billion a year, it's a pretty incredible number. But to the questions and that are very legitimate, one of the issues is that we just probably don't have enough enforcement or ways to be able to detect the problems, and that people are getting away with it because of the fact that they are not being enforced. And that comes down to some of the things that we do here and whether or not we are able to provide the enforcement that is necessary. And oftentimes, because of state budgets and because there's an inability to hire people that will actually do these jobs, we have that problem at our level too. So sometimes threatening to do things by changing the law will get people to do things right in case they do get caught. And so I think this is the kind of thing. It's a very point well taken, Senator Weber, that we have laws, and just by changing the laws doesn't necessarily mean it's going to change the situation, but you would hope that at least it does. And I'm not one that likes to increase penalties on people for doing things, but at the same time, when you see these kind of figures that are pretty impressive and very concerning, at some point in time you have to say we have to figure out a way to do it differently.
Okay. Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand the problem that you're trying to solve here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that this is the best solution here. I agree with what Senator Weber alluded to, which is if there's these things are already against the law. And so maybe our efforts should be focused at enforcing the current law and then also providing recourse to the people who have been done wrong, the people whose wages have been illegally deducted or taken away. And so I just think I'm understanding this is an informational hearing only, but I would think it's really important to really focus on enforcement of the current laws and then providing recourse for those who have been wronged. And I don't really see a lot of that in this bill in front of us right now. And the one thing I will want clarification on is at one point, I heard a testifier say it was willful or repeated discrepancies, and then I heard willful and repeated. And I would say, obviously, and is really the operative word here. There's a big difference. And then lastly, just let me mention that I know business owners who have had ongoing discrepancies with the Department of Revenue that have made mistakes, and it's taken months to have those mistakes corrected, where the Department of Revenue has deducted too much money. And yet it's taken months for business owners to get that remedied. And yet there was no recourse or no interest was paid on that money that was taken. So I would think that we would expect our state agencies to also follow any rules that we talk about as far as penalties and such. So I think, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And as this would progress, we would expect our state agencies to also fall in line with any of these type of penalties.
Senator Thomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I think we're on the same page. We're just saying it differently. And quite frankly, I don't understand why the IRS doesn't have to pay us interest when they make a mistake. But I suppose we'd have to appropriate more money at the government level in order for that to happen. And so I don't know if we're willing to do that either. So.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the questions. Thank you, Senator Thomasoni, and to your witnesses. And we'll set Senate File 1328 aside. And next we'll call up Senator Latt, Senate File 1330, and kind of keep an eye on the clock because, in fairness, we do want to give some time for opposition. But Senator Latt, welcome to the committee, Senate File 1330.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I don't know how much time you've got in terms of eye on the clock, so you keep the eye on the clock
okay.
And let me know if you need me to wrap up. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1330 is intended to address a livability issue which is significant and critical to the ability of workers in certain kinds of jobs, mostly retail and food service jobs, to be able to sustain their families and their schedules. It is styled the Fair Scheduling Act. And that is essentially what it does. With the advent of just-in-time labor practices, store managers often use computer algorithms of real-time sales data to build work schedules, allowing employers to call in staff on a moment's notice or cancel shifts if business tapers off. However, this often leaves workers, often women and people of color, holding the bag, scrambling to piece together child care and family care coverage, school schedules, and other basic activities of everyday life. According to recent academic research, 56% of men and 61% of women in the workforce are paid by the hour, many in industries like retail and food service. And researchers from the University of Chicago recently found 41% of hourly workers learn their schedules less than 1 week in advance. Half of hourly workers have no control over their schedule. Among the 74% of workers who report weekly fluctuations in hours, average hours varied by 49% of their usual weekly hours. For example, a 10-hour week can follow a 30-hour week. The bill makes sure that we're investing in students and families who are working hard to get by creating standards that do the following. Guarantee predictable schedules so people can work hard and still plan ahead for things like college classes, doctor appointments, and parent-teacher conferences. Compensate employees for their time and flexibility when last-minute scheduling changes happen. Just like someone who puts in extra hours earns overtime pay, so too should someone who sacrifices their personal life to be available to the employer on short notice. The bill protects people from unhealthy schedules, like those that require an employee to close late at night and turn right around to open the next morning. And the bill establishes basic living standards through scheduling that people can count and plan on. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to step the committee briefly through the contents of the bill. Section 2, the first substantive section of the bill, fits these provisions into the appropriate section of Chapter 171 so that the commissioner has the authority to engage in enforcement action in connection with its other substantive provisions. Section 3 provides that among those provisions, the employer is liable for the predictability pay that is referenced later in the bill and specifies the civil damages that are accountable under any violations of the predictability pay provisions, an amount equal to twice the unpaid wages, and civil penalty specifications, which increases for these provisions and for the others that are listed in this section of statute from $1,000 up to $5,000, but no more than $10,000 for each violation for each employee. Section 4 of the bill requires that the earnings statement that is provided with each employee's paycheck contains more information, information that would enable the employee to be able to monitor whether or not they are receiving the pay to which they are entitled under these provisions in this bill. Section 5 requires an employer's statement to the employee so that the employee is informed about their rights under this bill and therefore can monitor their schedule and the scheduling process to make sure that the law is complied with so they are aware of what their rights are. Section 6 is a substantive section of the bill that provides notice for employee schedules. And in particular, following the definitions, which are contained in Subdivision 1 at the bottom of page 5, you'll see the notice provision that an employer must give at least 21 days' notice of what the schedule is going to be. Go on to the next page, page 6. Among the provisions, I'll highlight one of that paragraph G on line 19. An employer must not require an employee to seek or find a replacement employee for shifts or hours an employee is unable to work. If you go to line 21, then subdivision 3 provides that an employee has a right to request a flexible working arrangement at any time. And they must make that request in writing. If you go back to the definition section on line 5.10, You'll see that flexible working arrangement means a change in employees' terms and conditions with respect to work schedule, including modifying the work schedule, changing their start or end times, going to a part-time or job-sharing arrangement, working from home, telecommuting, and so on. And those are requests for those changes. The employer must engage in an interactive process to determine if they can grant that request, and they must grant that request in the event that the reason for the request is because of an employee's serious health condition, responsibilities as a caregiver, or their enrollment in a career-related educational training program, or because of a reason related to a second job. Subdivision 4, we're now at the top of page 7, subdivision 4, requires predictability pay. So once a schedule is established within 21 days of the work day that's scheduled, but not less than 24 hours from, so between that window, 24 hours to 21 days, an employer may change the scheduled shift by subtracting hours, add hours, or canceling a shift, or changing the start and end time of that shift. But if they do so, then the employee will receive 1 hour of predictability pay. In other words, whatever their hourly rate of pay is, they'll get compensated to compensate them for making the shift in their work schedule to accommodate the employer's needs. Similarly, within 24 hours of the start of their shift, there's also a 1 hour predictability pay if the change is to the start or end time without changing the number of hours, or is to add hours to a shift. However, or in addition to that, if they're scheduled to work a shift and they're within that 24 hours, and the employer either cancels the shift or reduces the hours in the shift, then the predictability pay is 4 hours. So 4 hours of pay in order for the employee to accommodate either the cancellation of their shift altogether or a reduction in the hours to be worked on that shift. These provisions do not apply in Subdivision 5, where employers have suspended their operations due to threats to employees or their property. Civil authorities have recommended no work, failure of public utility systems, or natural disaster or weather. Subdivision 6 addresses the concern about employees being required to work late to close a store, for example, and then arrive early the next morning to open a store. They have a right to have sufficient rest. In this case, at least 11 hours of work, or 11 hours of off time or rest time. If they and they have a right to decline those kind of shift working shifts. If they choose not to decline and to accept the shorter rest period, then they are entitled to 1.5 times the regular hour of pay for any such hours that are worked. Subdivision 7 provides that the employer cannot discriminate against employees because based on the number of hours they're scheduled to work among similarly situated employees. If the work is the same, the hourly rate, or if the duties are the same kind of equal skill and effort. Similarly, they cannot condition eligibility for leave or time off or raises or promotions based upon the number of hours that an employee is scheduled to work as between comparable employers and positions. What it also provides in Subdivision 8 is that an employer, if they have additional hours of work available in positions held by current employees, that the employer must offer those hours to current qualified employees before they hire new employees or contractors, including going to temporary services or staffing agencies. Subdivision 9 is a record-keeping requirement so that records of everything that's already described in the bill are maintained for review by an employee or by an investigating agency. Subdivision 10 on page 9 prohibits employer retaliation, either discharge or other adverse employment action, against any person in retaliation for asserting a claim or right under this section, or for assisting anyone else in doing so, or for informing anyone else about their rights under this section. Any adverse action that is taken within a year of these kinds of activities raise a presumption that the action was retaliatory, subject to rebuttal. Subdivision 11 provides for individual remedies for the employee to bring a civil action in court to enforce their rights under this section, and provides for civil damages and costs and fees that are specified in Subdivision 11. And I note this because it's come up in the other bills as well. The section does not apply to employees covered under collective bargaining agreement with an employer. And for my 2 cents worth, I didn't draft the bill, but especially with regard to these kinds of provisions, they are often the kinds of provisions that are collectively bargained for in terms of schedule and so on. So it seems to me that that it would be appropriate to, where there is collective representation, that these issues be dealt with at the bargaining table. But in many circumstances, there is no collective representation for bargaining to take place, and this bill would set the baseline then for all employers that are not involved in a collective bargaining agreement. So that's the basics of the bill. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions, and we do have some witnesses that would like to provide information to the committee.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Lance right now? Senator Lance, I apologize, but I could maybe just have you bring one of your witnesses forward if they want to explain a story. We've been at it for an hour and a half with the supporters, and I think it's only fair that we give the opposition a little bit of time. But I certainly would be willing to hear from one of your testifiers, if that's okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know which one to choose. There are three that have made the trip here to the Capitol.
Okay, well, maybe if they can be brief then. But I think
to do that, I would certainly appreciate that. And I'll ask the advocates who put the list together.
Right. Or come forward if you can just be brief, then that's all I would ask.
If we could do all three and have them to be brief with their testimony, I'd sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Lennox Thornswood. I work as a retail worker at a big box retail store in downtown Minneapolis, and I've had several issues with scheduling. I first started working at closing shifts, which would end at 10:45 at night, and then I would have to take a bus around 10:56, which was usually fine for me, but sometimes we would get out late, or very often we would get out late, and I would miss my bus and have to wait for 30 minutes by myself at 11 p.m. at night in downtown Minneapolis as a woman, which is terrifying. And so I started becoming very uncomfortable with these shifts. So I asked for an availability. I requested an availability change and was denied and was told that I have to close and at least once a week, which may not sound that bad, but half an hour sitting by yourself as a woman in downtown Minneapolis at night is a lot for every single week. And also what would happen is, so I would end up getting home at like 11:30, midnight, and sometimes I would be scheduled the next morning and have to wake up like 5 a.m. So at most I would be getting 5 hours of sleep at night, which is not, I wouldn't be able to function at work. I would not be doing my job so well, but I had to do it for fear that I might be fired or some sort of retaliation. And I mean, I know we have a little bit of time, but I could go on forever about all these scheduling issues that I've had to experience. But I hope you consider this bill because it's a very serious and real issue for me and all of my coworkers.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thornswood. Thank you. And Sarah Lance, I don't know, would you like to bring a...
Thank you. Yeah, is Mr. Hurlboss here?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for hearing me today, Chairman and the Board. My primary concern with fair scheduling is both in making sure that people get the hours they're promised. They say they're going to get 40 a week. That's what they plan for. If they end up losing a day or two, then they don't have enough money to live, either to support themselves or their entire family. In my case, it happened when our hours got cut in our entire store. We actually had to let someone go because we didn't have enough hours to support all the people. And because that happened, we actually ended up getting more merchandise stolen. And then it just did not end up being a very good situation for the people, closing and opening constantly to make sure that we could support the only three people we had, when four was more than enough, but three wasn't. That is the short version of everything, and that's all the time we have for it today. So,
thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing your story and being so patient.
Thank you. And Octancia Williams, or Adams, rather. Octancia Adams.
Ms. Adams, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I work for Neighborhoods Organizing for Change as an organizer, and I am working to build a base of workers that have workers' rights issues, and I support the bill because I, too, have had to work and not be scheduled fairly. I've worked temp jobs a lot, and there's not a set schedule. If you take an assignment, there's probably an 8 to 5 for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they'll make you say, well, you have to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that's at 5 p.m. So I feel like there should be more time in between the way that low-wage workers and temp workers are scheduled to come into work. And I have a lot of other workers that I work amongst while I work for Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, and they face the same issues. Like, I invited a few of them out to come today to testify, but they couldn't get off work because they had to work, and that there was not enough notice. So I think that if you guys can support the bill, that it would make a lot of us low-wage workers more comfortable with their work and their jobs and their families. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Adams, for being here. Any questions for any of the witnesses or for Senator Latz?
So, Mr. Chairman, these very brief anecdotes highlight some of the anecdotal concerns here, and I've no doubt that it's more widespread than just the three that are here. If you're counting on a certain number of hours to be able to work, to pay your rent, or to put the food on the table, and the employer cuts those hours back at the last minute, it makes it very hard to plan and to budget. If your employer calls you in at a time when you've already got doctor's appointment scheduled or something scheduled for a child, and you have to go in for fear that you're going to lose your job, and you cancel that appointment, the employer could very well turn around a day later and cancel your new hours. In the meantime, you've left canceled a doctor's appointment or making arrangements for daycare, and you've canceled a babysitter. And then it's too late. Or you've hired a babysitter to make an accommodation for the employer. And then you're out the money that's involved sometimes in these situations as well. You've made incurred expenses that you wouldn't otherwise have incurred. So a certain amount of predictability is really, really important for people just to maintain a solid family working environment. And that's what this bill is all about. It's not to hamstring the employers, but it's to make sure that both the employers and the employees have that kind of predictability that's necessary to lead a decent life.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Latz. Any questions for Senator Latz? If not, thank you very much. We'll set aside Senate File 1330. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
With that, we'll like to move on to some opposition testimony. Maybe we could bring up a few of you at a time. I have Ryan Mick, Cindy Ross, and Jared Peterson, if you'd like to come forward and address the committee on individual or all the bills.
Thank you, everyone, for having us. My name is Cindy Ross. I'm the owner of Bright Star Care, serving Washington County. We are a private pay home care agency serving both medical and as well as non-medical needs. The concerns that I have for this last bill that was just presented, the 1330 Fair Scheduling Act, it may have an effect on the certain industries that he was driving that bill towards. However, we're in an industry that would be greatly affected from it. We are the firefighters of the healthcare industry. What we do is we typically are serving families who may not have family members nearby when they get discharged from a hospital. One family in particular, the daughter lived in Michigan, her brother lived in another state. The father was caring for his wife with dementia, and he had stage 4 cancer and had to be admitted immediately to the hospital. The wife needed 24/7 care. She could not be left alone, and we were the only option for them to get that kind of care. We do not have a crystal ball to be able to provide 21-day advance notice. The other thing is we don't have a crystal ball when a client's going to pass away or if they have a scheduling change. The margins are so thin in my type of business that I cannot afford to have employees sitting on the bench waiting to be discharged like firefighters. Many firefighters, by the way, have volunteers that do that, and they drop everything that they're doing. What we have is what's called flexible part-time. The caregivers that we have on our team, I just spoke to two new employees this morning, and I asked them, because of this meeting today, why did you get into this business? Why do you like working for this type of flexible part-time employment? They said that they love the flexibility. Many of my employees are actually nursing students, and they would never be able to have the kind of paying job that they have through my agency without the flexibility that we provide for them. If they have a doctor's appointment, if they've got finals, if they have to do clinicals, all they have to do is tell us, and we will find another caregiver to take that their place. They're not in jeopardy of losing their job. Our job as employers is to employ enough caregivers on our bench so that when those kind of unforeseen things happen, that we can replace it with another employee. The ultimate losers in this is going to be the actual customers that are paying for this privately. Medicare pays for cure. They don't pay for care. We are a private pay form of agency. If we have to incur these additional costs and guarantee that people, if someone pay, for example, if someone were to pass away, I'm going to have to tell those families that I'm going to have to collect for the hours scheduled 21 days in advance. I'm not so sure that's going to be economically feasible for many of those employers. So that's all I have at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ross. Mr. Peterson? Or
Mr. Chair, many members, my name is Jared Peterson. I'm the owner of two Touching Hearts at Home franchises. We provide a similar services to what Ms. Ross provides. And I'm not going to. I will echo everything that she said. That's absolutely correct. Really, for us, the business realities dictate the schedules. It's not us that decide. It's our clients that decide when they need service. People don't say, 21 days in advance, I think I'm going to get sick in 3 weeks. And we need to be able to respond to that and provide those services for those folks. I think that if we hamstring ourselves in scheduling like this, it not only harms the customers of not just our types of industries, but all types that have that rely on customers that come in at unpredictable times. It also can possibly harm employees if we have to make changes to their schedules, but there's a financial hit that the employer takes. They may not be willing to make some of those changes that the employees request when they do. I asked, in preparation of coming here, I asked my scheduler. I said, I explained kind of what the outline of these rules were. I said, how would that work? And she said, are you crazy? We can't do that. It's impossible. I couldn't do that. And I asked her, how many events that would trigger this this type of pay happen in a regular week? And she said, probably 20 that fit into that would require predictability pay. That's another employee that we could hire and pay. So really, we're limiting our ability to hire folks. We're limiting our ability to provide services to our clients, as well as other industries do as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Mick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Mick. I'm an employment lawyer by trade, and I represent the Minnesota Employment Law Council, which is a coalition of some of Minnesota's largest employers. I would like to talk as briefly as I can about some of the fundamental legal problems with a variety of the bills that have been raised and presented here today. I will try to be brief as I can. There are many problematic issues, some of which have been highlighted already, some of which have not. And so I certainly welcome questions from the committee, but I will try to go through these as quickly as I can and highlight some of those problems. Let me begin with the wage protection, the Wage Theft Protection Act. As members of the committee pointed out, much of what is being addressed in the Wage Theft Protection Act is already illegal. And we heard stories today demonstrating that it's illegal, and there are remedies for that. We've heard of neighborhood organizations that have been able to recover $1.8 million under existing law. So things like not paying employees, not giving breaks, there are already remedies for that under federal and state law. And those remedies include attorney's fees, so people who have been aggrieved have the right to have an attorney, and that attorney can be paid for their time. There are liquidated damages provisions under federal law, for example. In other words, if someone is not paid, they can recover double what they were not paid under federal law already. There are anti-retaliation provisions under federal law, for example. If you are fired for trying to recover unpaid wages in a lawsuit, that's another claim that you can make. So there are already existing laws that provide for these things. The problems with the legislation that's been proposed here is the burdens that it would create for the law-abiding employer. That is, this is not simply a bill that affects those who are not law-abiding. This would have serious ramifications for all employers in Minnesota, including those who are law-abiding. For example, there is a discussion of meal break protections. Minnesota already guarantees employees the right to a reasonable meal break period. What a bright line 30-minute meal period would do would be create litigation that we have seen in other states, and frankly, we saw in Minnesota before the courts clarified that a reasonable period isn't a bright line. In other words, employees who get a reasonable meal break but believe they only got 28 minutes or 29 minutes out of the 30 minutes can sue, or more aptly, a plaintiff's lawyer can sue on a class basis and say there was a minute that was denied. Not that employees didn't get a break, but a minute was denied, and therefore we're going to impose class action litigation on an employer, large or small. Another provision of this bill that has significant ramifications for employers by creating litigation risks, and frankly, nobody wins, is the provision that would create a 6-year statute of limitation for these sorts of claims. These claims are typically raised within the existing limitations period, which is 2 or 3 years. After 4, 5, or 6 years, employers are in a very difficult spot to defend against those claims. Information is gone. People are gone. Institutional memory is gone. Employers simply can't explain what happened 6 years ago in order to respond to these things. So employees aren't winning. They have every opportunity to bring their claims. Employers certainly are losing because they can't defend against these claims. So there are substantial burdens in that regard as well. Other problematic provisions of this proposal include the provision that would allow for anonymous complaints, including through third-party organizations. To put it bluntly, that's simply not how we do law in Minnesota and the United States of America. If you're accused of something, you have a right to know who's accusing you and what those allegations are, not simply that there's an allegation that's come in through a third party that you've done something wrong. And it's certainly not the case that that kind of complaint can then allow an agency to come in and conduct effectively discovery, not about a particular individual's complaint, but delving into the records of every employee in that company. So the possibility here is that an employer could be faced with a charge from someone they don't know based on facts that they haven't been told, from a third-party organization who has an interest here, and that opens up their entire record system about every employee that they have to examination in order to look for what may or may not be a pattern or practice of violations. That's contrary to principles of due process. Further, and perhaps even most egregious about this proposal, is the notion that an employer could be accused of retaliation. Not that retaliation shouldn't be prohibited, but this bill would, in a way that I think is unprecedented not only in Minnesota but under American law in general, put the burden on the employer to disprove that they've done something wrong, and otherwise guilty until proven innocent. And not only proven innocent, but proven innocent under a higher standard. Not simply more likely than not, which is the standard under Minnesota law today, but the employer would have to demonstrate clear and convincing evidence, whatever that means, that they didn't do wrong. any time an employee raises a complaint of retaliation within a year of making some sort of complaint. That's not how we do law in Minnesota and the United States of America. The next bill that I'd like to talk about briefly is the sick and safe time provision. In addition to some concerns that have already been raised by the chair and the members, as I mentioned, Minnesota Employment Law Council represents large employers, and large employers in the state already provide these sorts of paid leave benefits. The problem for this bill for the large employers is that by creating very rigid structures about how paid leave has to be handled in terms of accrual and payout, it puts your multi-state employers in the position of not having to deal with one way of doing business with respect to these issues, but multiple. If you do multiple issues, if you do business in California and New York and Massachusetts and Seattle and San Francisco, as many large employers do, you have to deal with multiple laws creating inconsistent mechanisms for having to accrue this paid leave. Again, not that employers are not doing so, but it simply becomes impossible to administer 3, 4, 5, 6 inconsistent ways of having to create and sustain and keep records for your paid leave for employees. Then let me just briefly address the fair scheduling law. Again, this law doesn't simply provide for predictability pay, which is problematic in and of itself, as I'll address here in a moment, but it prohibits employers from requiring someone to work on a different schedule within 21 days. Employers cannot, and we've heard some examples of that, simply know 3 weeks out what the schedule is going to be. And there are different impacts in different industries where if an employee doesn't come in or isn't available on less than 21 days, the employer is in a difficult position, whether that's banking where you need to have a certain number of employees to open a branch, retail or convenience stores where you have to have a certain number of employees available for safety concerns. Any number of those situations, employers simply can't predict 21 days out what's going to happen. In other words, the concern has been raised about just-in-time scheduling. The vast majority of employers in the state don't use that. And even for those that do, I would venture that the majority of instances where a schedule has to be adjusted, it's not because of a computer system. It's because an employee has had something come up. They've asked for a flexible work week. They've had a medical issue come up, as permitted, of course, under Minnesota sick leave law. And in those instances, the employer has to make an adjustment. So it's not the employer out to save a dollar. It's an employer trying to do business in a difficult environment, dealing with circumstances that are outside their control. There's also a real concern about the mandatory flexible scheduling provision in the law. In other words, employees can demand something, and they don't have to negotiate or work something out with the employer in several key respects. That is, if they want to go to school or if they have a second job or if they believe they have caregiver responsibilities, they can demand whatever they want in terms of a flexible schedule. And it's not just one employee that can do that. All of them can do that. Can you imagine as an employer that has multiple employees that want to demand inconsistent flexible work weeks, work schedules? And oh, by the way, if they do that in less than 21 days' notice, that's going to impact your schedule for everyone else, and you're going to have to pay them, not because of what you did, but because you're trying to be flexible to another employee. That, again, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, that's simply not workable. And you think about industries like agriculture in Minnesota, where you're dealing with weather or you're dealing with agricultural production in your planting and harvesting season. You don't have 21 days notice of what the weather's going to be or what production is going to be or what your customers are going to demand. You have a day or less, and you have to make adjustments. Or you're in the middle of your planting and harvesting season and employees aren't going to get an 11.5-hour break between shifts. They can't. Or you're a legislator and you're in the heat of the legislative session. Your staff is going to work late into the night and have to be there the next morning. Again, many industries have that. And it's not bad faith on any employer's part. It's just how industries work, where they can't provide those kind of breaks. And in my experience, employers aren't out to get employees. They work with them. But industries and circumstances and customers make demands that they have to meet in order to stay in business. There's also the provision in the Fair Scheduling Act that is the retaliation problem. Again, in other words, if an employee asks for a flexible schedule, and by the way, even if the employer grants it, and within 365 days, the employer has no choice but to terminate that employee, for example, because they don't show up or their performance is bad. That employer is now a presumptive bad actor if this bill passes under the law of Minnesota. And the only way that they can avoid liability, and by the way, they're going to have to spend tens of thousands of dollars or more to defend themselves in that case. But the only way they avoid liability is to come up with a heightened standard of evidence that they didn't do anything wrong. And that's not how law works in Minnesota and the United States of America. If the committee has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will yield the remaining time that we have to others. I know there are others who want to speak to this.
Right. No. Thank you very much, Mr. Mick. Any questions for these witnesses, members? We're getting close to four, but thank you very much. Thank you for your patience. Next on the list, I have Ms. Nienau, Ms. Bears, and Mr. Reuter, if you'd like to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee, and whichever one of you would like to go first, please just state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Shayna Nienau. I'm the director of HR for Cascade Hospitality. We operate the Crave restaurants and other brands here in Minnesota. I've been in the hospitality industry for 20 years. Seven of those I worked as a tipped employee. I'm here today to provide some information and perspective regarding the credit card fees that restaurants are required to pay on the bill regarding the issue in Senate File 216. It sounds like there may be some misconceptions regarding credit card fees, and here are the basic facts. Credit card fees are not optional. Restaurants are required to pay the processing fees taken by credit card companies. Restaurants are not taking anything from the employees. These credit card fees come off the top before restaurants receive funds from the card processor. Restaurants do not charge servers for the credit card fees for the total bill or the entire bill. The fee charged by the credit card processor is proportional to the food and drink tab and the tip. The credit card fees are a shared responsibility between the employer and the employee. We want our employees to be successful and earn as much money as they can. Good tips mean our customers and staff are happy. The reality is that over 90% of all transactions in our restaurants use credit cards. Credit cards are convenient and easy to use, but when we accept them, we also accept the terms of the processing agreement. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you. I would also like to comment on the legislation in Senate File 1330 regarding scheduling. We're also concerned about legislation that would establish the one-size-fits-all approach to scheduling. We work closely with our employees to make sure their schedules work for them. Again, happy employees mean happy customers. We already have a consistent and regular methodology for sharing work schedules with our employees. Employees are often interested in adding shifts to earn additional income. This bill could end up harming their ability to work in some of those circumstances. Having good relationships with our employees is critical to the success of our restaurants. Adding a layer of government complexity to the scheduling process is not necessary. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nienau. Mr.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Dave Reuter. I'm the Vice President of Personnel for Thrifty White Pharmacy. We operate 50 pharmacies in Minnesota and employ about 1,100 Minnesotans in those stores. We operate in small rural communities around the state, so a lot of the county seat type locations. And my concern is with the sick and safe bill. Thrifty White Pharmacy already provides this benefit to our employees and understands its importance, and we see it used often. However, there's a lot of overreaching aspects to the bill that we're particularly concerned about. One is the definition of the employee, that benefit extends out to a long list of family members, which really limits the employer's ability to try to have any control and any basically control over how that sick pay is used. It's a very easy process to be able to get a doctor's note to help somebody who's in need, and we see that often. But to allow that, as the chair had mentioned earlier, to have 3 days that have to expire before the employer can ask questions about the need for that time, is very disruptive for a business. Another piece that's in there is the paid sick leave would apply if schools are closed due to weather. That's very worrisome for us as we run pharmacies. If schools are closed at noon, do we need to let all of our employees leave for the day that have a child, grandchild, even a grown child, by definition, to go home? Can we expect them to come back at 2:30 when the school would have closed? If school hadn't been closed, those employees would have still been working. So we don't know how to handle that. The other piece is that, obviously, it's very expensive for us. Our pharmacies run on a small number of employees. There's typically one pharmacist, two pharmacy technicians, and a clerk. Whenever anybody is absent in that crew, with such a small crew, it has a big impact on our service. It takes us about 6 months to train an employee just to become a pharmacy technician. The state of Minnesota, by law, requires 240 hours of training for that technician. We can't just go out and reach in the phone book or call friends to come in and try to help. There's nothing they could do to help provide prescriptions for our patients. Bigger concern yet would be who would be working in our pharmacies to fill prescriptions. We provide prescriptions for over 20,000 nursing home residents. If our employees get paid to stay home, for a lot of employees, that's a pretty easy choice. By state law, a pharmacy cannot open its doors or hand out a filled prescription if a pharmacist isn't on duty. So one person making the decision to stay home means every employee in that store needs to go home for that day, and our patients do not receive their medications. I think it's important to also realize this bill does not exist in a vacuum. Each one of these bills layers on an additional expense. There were three different bills today that all talked about new requirements for a wage statement to employees. Makes it very difficult for an employer to be able to comply with the law when you've got something pertaining to the same issue in three different bills. We anticipate that this bill alone, the safe scheduling, or I'm sorry, the sick and safe bill, could cost us up to $250,000 a year. Again, that's not in a vacuum. The minimum wage increases and the automatic steps that are coming, we know will also cost Thrifty White Pharmacy $250,000 per year. At the same time that the state is legislating expenses that are increasing to us, we're also seeing reimbursements for a lot of our business from state Medicaid being cut. They're trying to get down to an actual acquisition cost. That just leaves an employer in a very difficult position. If you're getting cut on what you're being reimbursed for service, you're also having legislated expenses being added on to the bottom line. All we can do is become more efficient. $500,000 a year buys a lot of automated check stands and other equipment to help run a business. One thing that's unique is Thrifty White is also 100% employee owned. So that means there are no outside shareholders. The only people who own any part of the company and share in the profits of the company are the employees. So all of these expenses hurt every one of our employees directly. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Bears?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Bears. I work for Four Crone in the Human Resource Department. Four Crone is a franchisee for Wendy's, and we're also a member of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We have 55 restaurant locations, with 52 of those stores in Minnesota. We have 1,760 employees. And just a little bit about me is I have 30 years of restaurant experience. I've worked in any roles from human resources to district manager to general manager, and also in the server capacity. I also have a teaching degree. You know, for us, scheduling is a process. And to be successful at that process, you have to be able to have the skills to make it an art, to be able to meet the needs of both those external customers and our internal customers, which are our employees. So what is that process? For us, that's done on a weekly basis. We are available hours that we schedule are based on productivity and sales goals plans, and we actually use formulas so that if we predict that we're going to have a $300 hour in sales, we'll schedule 7 employees for that. Or if we're going to have $1,000 in sales, we'll schedule 16 employees for that. And where do we get all that data? You know, you start with that first, the data piece, and you get all the historical data. So you look at things from a year back, and then you look at what the last 2 weeks are. We look at what our customer per hour, our sales per hour are. Then we take our forecasting, and that includes anything from what's going on. Are there holidays? Are there customer flows? What's the workload? What's the weather? And then we look at the employees' availability. What have they requested for their time off? What positions and certifications do they have? Do they prefer more or less hours? Are they new hires? All this takes place before we actually write that schedule. And currently we do our schedules we write them on Tuesday and Wednesday, and they're posted on Thursday, and that runs for the week that starts on a Monday through Sunday basis. So we have many changing variables. The forecasting becomes less accurate the farther out that those predictions are made. Things like the weather, traffic, roads, constructions, and the less accurate those projections are, this affects both the employer and the employee to have smooth running shifts to satisfy the employer, the employee, and the customer. So our goal is to have it right, the right amount of people, at all the right times. Retail employees want and they expect flexible work schedules. Our industry works well for students and part-time employees. We have lots of part-time people. Of those 1,760 employees, 650 are full-time, so about 40%, and then the rest are part-time positions. And we match that employee availability with the needs of our store. So if an employee tells us they're only available from 11 to 2, then that's the schedule that we work in. Or if they're going to school on Tuesday and Thursday, or they've got a Wednesday night bowling league, we make all those accommodations. We also hire seasonal employees, and that's based on our business. And many employees come to us because they're out of school for the summer or because they're looking for some additional holiday income. You know, we just did a crew survey, and one of the questions we asked was, what makes you want to stay with us? The number one answer was, well, my manager and my coworker. And the second most answer was flexible hours because they work with me and they love working with us because of that flexibility. So if we work so hard to get that schedule right, why does the schedule change? There's requests, there's weather, there's unexpected events, there could be illness or those unexpected resignations, or we call them no calls, no shows. So why am I concerned with this bill on scheduling? Because of the external and internal factors that affect scheduling and sales trends. We need the flexibility to respond to these factors. If there's a 21-day posting mandate, we're forced to write our schedule a month out, and that affects our employees also. They talked about being able to schedule doctor's appointments, those kinds of things. 21 days is a long way out. Currently, our employees provide their availability, and maintain requests for additional hours or time off in a much closer time frame. They pick up additional shifts. They can switch and trade shifts. There was verbiage in there about not being able to find a replacement. But we don't ask them or mandate that they do. We don't require it. We ask them if they tried. They now request schedules when this posting schedule has already been made. And there are rare instances when an employee is cut before the end of the shift, but they're also asked who wants to go. The opportunity to stay late or pick up extra shifts far outweighs any time of lost hours. The other thing is, I think there's a potential for confusion with this mandate, and it's very complex. For example, you know who's going to have to administer this? That would be me, working in the human resource, explaining how it works. And I had some trouble understanding. For example, if an employee is helping a customer, they're scheduled till 2 o'clock, and now they clock out at 2:10, does that mean we've changed their hours and we pay? Or if they clock out at 1:56 and they were scheduled to 2, is there a change in the schedule? Because we don't round up or down with our schedule. We pay for the hours that people work. They're talked about reasons related to a second job or if they have career-related educational programs. And we're required to make those accommodations. The bill also talks about flexible working arrangements. and that there's a very specified timelines for these meetings and written notices that must be provided. This process is, sounds to me, very difficult and sets the process in stone, when now, to me, it's more of a common sense. You work with the team, you work it out, and you reach a resolution. So in my opinion, this bill has a negative potential for a negative impact on employee opportunity. It's overly burdensome for a problem that we don't have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bears. Thank you all for your testimony. I think it was important to get that on the record, and I appreciate your patience in being here. We do have another committee that needs to get in here, but I will ask members if there's any questions of these witnesses before we adjourn for today. But thank you all very much for being here for this important hearing. We appreciate it. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.